Hey Team Health Tech, I've got an exciting special bonus episode for you here on the audio podcast. Now, you might know that Talking Health Tech produces this podcast that's been running for over 5 years with over 400 episodes, but we also produce a number of other podcasts that are in the healthcare space that are part of our Talking Health Tech podcast network. Well, we have a new show that's joined the network. It's one that's been running for 3 seasons before coming over to us, and it's called Talking Blood Cancer by the Leukemia Foundation. The Talking Blood Cancer podcast is for people who've been diagnosed with a blood cancer and their loved ones, and they share stories with individuals who've faced blood cancer in the hope that it might offer insights and inspiration and hope. It's hosted by Kate and Marianne from the Leukemia Foundation, and I know you're going to love it. Season 4 of Talking Blood Cancer has just gone live, so we're celebrating the launch by sharing episode 1 from season 4 with you now on this feed. If you enjoy this one, make sure you jump into the show notes of this episode and click through to subscribe to their podcast, or just search Talking Blood Cancer in your favorite podcast player like Apple Podcasts or Spotify and follow along. Here we go.
You get to a point in life where you think you're in control of everything, and all of a sudden it gets taken out from underneath you.
I guess I kind of felt ripped off.
It's just living in the moment and just being adaptable to situations.
Give people voices to talk about, do you know what, that phase is often the hardest, and be prepared for it because it's not what you think it will be.
Talking Blood Cancer, a podcast for those facing blood cancer by the Leukemia Foundation.
Find the best way forward using their own purpose that they have in their life and using their passions.
I've lost fear and doubt. Like, I no longer doubt myself in situations, and nothing scares me.
That gives you another goal to work towards and a reason to live.
Hi, I'm Kate Arkadiv, and I am the host of Talking Blood Cancer. This podcast shares the stories of the people we have connected with who have faced a blood cancer, so that you, our listeners, can gain insight, find purpose, and take inspiration. Before we get into today's episode, the Leukemia Foundation acknowledges the traditional owners of the land on which we share these stories. We recognise their continuing connection to land, sea, and community. As the first storytellers of this country, we pay our respects to their elders, past and present. This story may contain content that some listeners may find difficult and challenging. We encourage anyone listening to take care of their own mental health and well-being. The purpose of this podcast is to share real-life stories of people living with a blood cancer, and any discussion of medical treatments is not an endorsement. We encourage you to seek advice from your treatment team if you have any questions regarding your diagnosis, side effects, or treatment. If you would like to talk to someone, or even if you would like more information on our services or today's episode, please feel free to contact 1-800-620-420, and someone will be able to connect you with your local blood cancer support coordinator. So, let's get into today's episode. Welcome back to the first episode of Talking Blood Cancer in 2024. We are so excited to share with you the first episode of Season 4. Today, you will hear the conversation that I had with Peter Geary. Peter was first diagnosed with MGUS, which is a subtype of myeloma. Peter's initial treatment / monitoring was watch and wait. And 18 months after his initial diagnosis, it transformed into myeloma. Peter was required to start treatment in his local area on the Sunshine Coast, and later had to travel to Brisbane for an autologous stem cell transplant. Throughout Peter's story, you will hear his passion for ensuring that patients have equitable access to treatment, no matter where they are located in Australia. Hi there, I'm Kate Arkadiv, and thank you for listening to today's podcast. Today I have on with me the man by the name of Peter. So hi, Peter, thank you for coming on.
Hi, Kate. I'm Peter Geary. I was diagnosed with asymptomatic myeloma in 2018. Mm-hmm. I live on the Sunshine Coast with my wife, and it's a great spot to live. I was first picked up in 2017. I was feeling fine. I just went to the doctor for a regular blood test, and he found that my white cells were down somewhat, and that occurred for another couple of blood tests. So got referred to a hematologist in 2018, and he picked up that I had asymptomatic myeloma. Asymptomatic being that there is the paraprotein, which is the marker for the myeloma, is in my blood. But after a CT scan, there was no sign of lesions or bone damage. So I was really lucky I was picked up early.
Wow. How did you feel for you to have gone to the doctor one day? Were you feeling unwell in yourself, or were you just doing that usual yearly blood test?
Yeah. Is that what kind of- Yeah, that was it, just over 50 yearly blood tests for like more so for PSA and other markers to make sure all the organs are working. And, yeah, the white cell count being down was a bit of a surprise, but we worked through it. And so I was really lucky to be picked up early. And then from February 2018, I was, I guess some people call it smouldering myeloma, but my levels didn't increase and there was no need to have any medication or anything.
And so how did you feel during that time to hear that news? Had you ever heard of the word myeloma before, or was it all new to you?
No. A lot of people think of melanoma rather than myeloma.
They do. They absolutely do.
Yeah, so no, I'd already retired, but I was volunteering, doing community work. So I kept doing that and actually started a course, or I completed a course in looking after people with a disability through the NDIS.
Right.
And got that all finished. And then in 2019, in about May, my levels had gone up, not substantially, but enough to require chemo.
Yeah. So during that time, I'm just going to take you back to that watch and wait period because it's quite interesting for people. During that time, were you worried or were you concerned, or did you just continue living as you were?
Yeah, just business as usual, just still travelled, and actually had travelled overseas on a cruise, and I developed a cold sort of the last couple of days, which was the precursor to the fact that my white cells were down and my paraprotein was going up. So developed sort of a cold that took forever to, when your immune system's down, it might take five lots of antibiotics to get rid of a normal cold that should take one lot.
So in that time period, were you just, you've heard this diagnosis, but I'm going to carry on life as usual until then, until whenever I potentially needed treatment?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, my hematologist said had arranged to do 6 monthly checkups. So he was quite happy to just monitor the bloods, and everything was as it should be, except, you know, the white cells and the paraprotein hadn't increased at all over the sort of 18 months. So even when it was found that I needed to get treatment, we still had a trip down to Kangaroo Island, which was a couple of weeks. So he said, well, I'll just do that because it doesn't generally go up, doesn't generally spike. It goes up very slowly, the paraprotein build up. So, by end of June 2019, I started the 6 cycles of chemo, which was like a cycle's 4 weeks. And then in the end of each cycle, I had a drug for bone strengthening, which is called Zometa.
Yeah.
And that's just a precautionary thing because I didn't have any bone damage at this stage.
Yeah. And how did you feel having to, did your life have to pause quite a bit when treatment started, or were you able to continue your volunteer work or your study or things like that, or your travel?
Good question. No, we didn't travel. We had to cancel a couple of trips. But I arranged to have my treatment on a Friday, so I had a couple of days to get over the side effects of, like, particularly dexamethasone, which is a steroid and hypes you up and you sort of have dexy days.
How was that? I mean, lots of people talk about steroids, or sometimes a lot of people, they don't even put the pieces together to go, I feel really hyper, I can't sleep, or I'm irritable, or I'm cranky. How were those period for you and I guess your wife as well?
Yeah, well, actually, we managed it really well. It was quite funny because I was having my treatment and the hematologist came over and said, oh, those guys are on 20 milligrams of Dex every week and they're hyperactive. They're still awake at 2 in the morning. And he said, oh, how much are you on? And I said, oh, 40 milligrams. And he said, how do you manage that?
Yeah, how did you?
Said, I just took prednisone, I think. Anyway, I took Finergan, and I was taking that sort of calmed it down.
Yeah.
I mean, initially I had the normal sort of side effects of being awake till 3 a.m. and being hyperactive during the day. And once we got it managed, I didn't have, by the time, I only took the sleepers for a couple of days, and then rather than get into a habit of having to take them daily, by the end of the weekend, I was fine.
So did you get to a point yourself where you went, okay, this isn't working for me, this side effect, I know that this treatment's really important and I need to have this on board, but did you get to a point within yourself you went, I'm actually going to take control and help manage and change this situation?
No, I think it was day hospital I was attending was really helpful and, you know, holistic in their approach. And I was doing exercise physiology from the start.
Yeah.
To improve my fitness for when I had to go through the stem cell transplant and get the melphalan, which, you know, really knocks you around. So it was all sort of preparatory work for the stem cell transplant. Yeah, for what was ahead, yeah. So, yeah, it was pretty good.
Wow, yeah.
I was lucky I got referred to where I got referred to because everyone was really supportive, like the staff were great and you're well looked after, and it's a beautiful view out the window when you're sitting in your chair getting chemo and whatever. So it's a really positive place.
It is, and I think you're very right to have, what would you say would be your main people that you would go, yep, to having an exercise physiologist sound like it made a huge impact on you, and as you said, your preparation leading into transplant. So do you find the importance of including exercise in daily life, even though sometimes you might not necessarily feel like it whilst on treatment?
Well, I mean, it's critical, in my opinion, to do it prior because it helps you, as we said before, prepare, and also ongoing, like I'm still doing it now, you know, 5 years down the track. So because you lose a lot of when you're sort of not doing much because it is quite debilitating as much as sort of not being able to do much for a while once you in your recovery phase, tend to lose muscle tone and sort of really need to keep the exercise up.
Mm-hmm.
And we also do hydrotherapy and go to the pool and do our own exercises. And
did you do that beforehand? Was that?
Yeah, we did. We did. We went to the pool. My wife needs exercise as well because she's had a stroke. So we do a team effort.
Yeah.
She's my carer after I've been her carer for 30 years now. She's my carer.
Yeah. So. And how's that role position changed for you? I've heard a number of people have that.
Yeah, well, I mean, because of brain fog, that's the biggest thing that needs help with, because we have diaries and we sort of note those, and my wife does all the sort of paperwork and all the admin at home, whereas, you know, I used to do some of it as well, and she organises everything, appointment. Well, I my own appointments, but she helps out by reminding me that, you know, check your diary.
Yeah.
It's no point because
no point in having a diary if you don't check the diary.
That's it. Yeah, that's right. But I forget to check it because
your brain's
absent-minded. Yeah.
And was that hard for you, like that adjustment to go, I mean, when you're diagnosed, so much is also taken away, and some of the person you were before is no longer currently who you are or who you potentially will be. Was that hard to have to go, oh, yeah, I am forgetful and I'm not as maybe sharp or onto things as I was? Was that hard for you?
Yeah, it's just a matter of adjusting and managing it psychologically, I think, because it's there to stay. So even though Dr. Mann said vitamin B12 will help your brain function, and it's sort of an adjustment you have to make, and everyone has to make it because they're all basically in the same boat. And then there's also neuropathy, which is the other side effect, which affects your balance. And
where did you get that? In your feet or hands or both?
Feet. Well, unfortunately, I had hereditary neuropathy as well. So.
Oh, did you?
I had a double whammy, but that's manageable as well. I've just got I go to a podiatrist regularly and she checks my feet, and because a lot of the time you can't have sensation in your feet, so you've got to wear shoes all the time in case you're, because you're not aware of what you're treading on if you've got thongs or any, you know, light shoes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's another management sort of technique just to not overdo exercise either. That's a critical thing, is to try and have a balance. Like, you know, I find that I need to have a day off in between.
Did you have to learn that lesson?
Yes. I was doing a kilometre at the pool swimming, and I overdid it with my hereditary neuropathy, and my muscles in my shoulder stopped working. So I'd already learnt that before I got cancer. So I now just do, like today I did exercise physiology. Tomorrow I've got volunteering, which involves a lot of walking, but then I've got, you know, the weekend off or Friday off, and maybe we're going away, but normally go to the pool on Saturday. We do hydrotherapy Monday. So it's sort of, we got a cycle of exercise.
It's very true. And I think when I talk to people, you know, they want to be a bull at the gate and they want to get back into life, which I can absolutely appreciate. But it's really that balance to go, your body's been through a lot or is going through a lot. So it's, you almost have to find that pressure point, don't you, to go, I can do this. Like, you've now got that beautiful pattern of what you can do during the week and what works for you. And I think it's finding that it does. It takes that time to find what works and what doesn't and what is too much and what's too not enough.
Definitely. Yeah.
And that takes time, I would say.
Oh, it does. Yeah, I've taken a couple of years to get into to work out the routine and what I can do. And also people with more severe side effects or deficiencies like, you know, bone damage and that, they can still, it is still possible to do exercise physiology because it's not pumping iron. It's whatever you can do is what you do. They don't go and put you through some exercise that you say, I'm never going back again.
No.
They just start off gently, and everyone that is like hesitant to do exercise because of, you know, maybe have severe side effects.
Yeah.
They need to just try. Like, even you can go to exercise physiologists and they'll give you a sheet, email you a sheet of exercise you can do at home, and it's just need a rubber band, you want to exercise rubber bands.
Yeah.
Or just even on the bed, you can do crunches and leg raises and all sorts of things that are beneficial because it's just another way of keeping you more supple and helping mobility.
It's very much about helping you gain quality of life and the most out of life.
That's a key word, quality. Key words, quality of life is.
Yeah.
Yeah, people, another aspect of it is people are sort of told they have to have maintenance drugs, which affects their quality of life, but they don't necessarily, you know, like I had the choice, luckily, so I chose not to have Revlimid, which is creates a lot of issues for a lot of people. And that affects people's quality of life on a daily basis.
Yeah.
I think it's sad that there's, I mean, that different organisations are working towards a standard protocol for treatment so that...
The optimal care pathways, is that what you're referring to? Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And people should have a choice. If they're in remission, they should be able to say, well, I'd rather just not have... I found that Revlimid's or lenalidomide's the other word for it, that affected my, you know, my quality of life too much. I'd rather ease it up on it or cut it out for a time and see how that affects my levels. You know, they might... And some people are off Revlimid and they don't have any, they might have years of remission. Other people, you know, sort of, no one person's the same. So it's just sort of put a stamp on it and say, well, you've got to, you know, 25 milligrams of Revlimid a day to maintain your remission when they feel like crap.
Exactly. And it's about allowing people to be active participants in their treatment. And because it is their life, and doctors absolutely can give advice and direction, but it's what benefit are you getting from it in your life and how is it affecting you? Because you don't want to be miserable while living. As we've said, you want to have quality as well.
You've got to be psychologically out there knowing that if you do exercise, it's beneficial rather than feeling too sick to do it because you're on this drug that you don't necessarily have to take.
And did you feel that you did it, obviously I envision helping, having a really an open communication relationship with your hematologist, was that
really it was quite funny. He used to always, he'd even come into the gym to make sure I was there.
So that, you know what, it sounds like he believed it, he felt it was important.
Well, that was 5 years ago and he's still really convinced that it sort of hasn't been, it's being accepted more now as a sort of a must do, or, you know, you can, as I said, you can do exercises at home. You don't have to go and pay $100 a week to go and see an exercise physiologist. If you just get a kickstart with a lesson and then, you know, manage yourself, it's...
Yeah, there's actually a chronic disease management plan, which is a national incentive that people, they can go to their GP. You do need a longer GP appointment, And if they offer up to between 5 to 10 sessions with like podiatry, exercise physiologists, dietitians, and like those allied health services, where people can go and access these to partake in exactly what you're saying with exercise physiology at a reduced rate. I think that it should be something absolutely that's really encouraged, because it does. It not only helps with our body, but the mind. It helps release those endorphins. It also gives you a sense of purpose and control in your life as well.
Definitely. Actually, I'm going to a psychologist at the moment through that scheme.
Are you?
Yeah, because I was sort of getting a bit down on the fact that I'd lost a few friends to myeloma, and that people were on the support pages on Facebook were all sort of gloom.
Yeah.
And the lady said, "Oh, the first thing to do is get off Facebook, because you sort of try to help people because you've been through their experience, and quite often you have to say the same thing over and over to different people to get the message across, and it just got too frustrating." So, yeah, maybe you can even go to a psychologist or there's the mass that you can do. There's oncology massage people, there's dieticians. I mean, you can do all those sort of things under that scheme.
Yeah.
And I think even hearing, you know, because some people lose their hearing sometimes.
They do, I think all the things you're naming, and I can hear the things that you've tapped into, you've really created a village to help you through this. And on this path, it's not a path that anyone, I'm sure, puts their hands up and says, "Hey, I'll have a blood diagnosis, thanks." But it sounds like you haven't done this alone, and you've called on as many services and allied health and doctors, and even on called upon yourself and your wife that you can to help get you through.
Definitely, yeah. Well, I'm fortunate that the practice I go to, the day hospital, has all those professionals involved in the practice, so you can, it's all available. You know, they're all being sorted out to be the best people for advising people with cancer, because they do, the practice does radiology and as well as day hospital for cancer infusion. So yeah, I mean, it's not always that people aren't always that fortunate to fall into a place like a space like that where they've got everything they need, providing they just put their hand up and
Or make an appointment.
Yeah,
and even though sometimes, like, I know that, say, public versus private, some don't have, public doesn't have social workers, or everyone has different access to services. But I think what's really important for the listeners or anybody to know is that they are accessible, and you can reach out to the Leukemia Foundation, and we can help connect you in with services that may not be at your hospital, but within your local area or close within your local area. Because I think, you know, if we look back and think of the things of COVID, and the one great thing that it's done, it's really pushed the Australian medical delivery service online. So there is many things. I know I've spoken to so many people, say, out in the bush, that have done an exercise physiologist class online, you know, and had that.
It's just easy to sort of be instructed in that manner. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, like even like, you know, house phone consultations with your GP help a lot, especially if you have to be isolated, and because of the condition, sometimes your circumstances regarding your well-being change quite quickly. So you need to be able to get on to someone quickly rather than waiting 10 days for an appointment, then by which time you're in ER and, you know, on a drip or something. So,
So when did you have your transplant? Was that, did you say 5 years ago? Was that?
20th of December 2019.
Okay.
And they have a funny way of describing it as, you know, day zero, because that's your birthday for your new blood.
Yeah. Did you have your own stem cells put back in, or did So you had an autologous transplant.
After the chemo, they give you filgrastim, which is releases the stem cells from your bone marrow, and you get that for several days, and then they put you on this big, I can't remember the name of the machine, but it's like a giant centrifuge, and they can spin out whatever part of the blood they want, so they collect the stem cells.
It very much looks like dialysis.
Yeah, and they've got a little thing like a pH strip, different colours that they can work out what colour is stem cells, so they set it for that, and off you go. And they actually recirculate your blood three times, all your blood three times during the day, and then hopefully they can get enough on the first day to get enough for two I usually collect enough for two transplants in case you need another one.
Did you get enough in the one day, or did you have to?
Yeah, I got squillions.
Did you?
Which was good.
Yeah, so they have a rainy day collection for you.
Yeah.
You need it.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's right. But I don't know if I ever will, because things have improved so much.
Like, yeah.
My second line of treatment started in September 21.
Mm-hmm.
And I went on to daratumumab, which is immunotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
And the similar thing, you have to have Velcade and Dex for 3 months, and then daratumumab and Dex for 3 months, and then you went on to maintenance.
Yeah.
So that was, unfortunately, daratumumab doesn't work for everyone, but it's worked really well for me. So I'm down to 2 parts, 2 grams per litre, which is like 2 grams above remission.
Yeah.
But I've been at that level for 18 months, so I still have to have a monthly infusion.
Mm-hmm.
And the DARAT actually suppresses your white cells, so you've got to have immunoglobulin as well to balance out your immunity. So,
yeah. And so do you have that once a month as well, or is that?
Yeah, on the same day.
Yeah.
Like, it's about 5 hours once a month, which some people might find a bit much, but for me it's only 5 hours of the month that I'm not my normal self. Yeah, active. Yeah, so, I mean, it's not a big thing to put up with.
And I have spoken to a number of people, and they do say that they can get frustrated that they do have – that this isn't ending, that they think that sometimes, you know, I went through all that hard treatment, that intense treatment, but now this is forever, or this is what life is going to look like for a significant period of time. And I think you beautifully put it then, if you break it down into the month, like 5 hours, you go 5 hours – mass is not my strong point, but however many hours there are in a month, out of all of those hours, there is 5 hours I need to give to stop and to be able to continue living and to get this supportive therapy. So I think that's a really powerful message that you just gave, that it's that perspective, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm. I don't think of the other exercise activities like a burden on my lifestyle, because it's more or less, as you said, like, the 5 hours is maintaining your well-being and your quality of life, and as well as the exercise is both good psychologically and physically, and it's just helping to prolong your quality of life at the standard you have now.
Yeah.
Might add up to be another 30 hours a week, a month, but, you know, you're doing, it probably isn't even that much, probably 2-3 hours a week, or only 12 hours a month. That's not really, that's all you need with the other 5 hours, so 20 hours a month, and you're the person you always were, except for the side effects, which are manageable.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, as you said, over the course of the chat, it all sort of, one thing leads to another, and providing you have the right mindset and you get the right support, and you're lucky like me that was diagnosed asymptomatic, that you have a good team that doesn't force you to have maintenance drugs that are sort of debilitating for your well-being. It seems a bit weird having something that makes you work, feel bad. Like in America, apparently they have used thalidomide, which is good for getting rid of cancer, but people are worse off. They might be in remission, but their life's terrible because they've got painful neuropathy and their quality of life's worse even though they've been cured. So finding the balance to maintain your, as close as possible to what you were like before you were diagnosed is the aim.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think with the conversation I've sat with you in today, that it hasn't just been a stroke of luck that's all happened for you. It's not only like luck absolutely plays a part, but I think you've been so active in your journey and in your healing and in your journey to be able to gain back quality of life, that I think we can't always expect that a doctor's going to have the miracles or the prescription to do it. And I think I mentioned it before, it's so important that people are that active participant in their healthcare and in their life as well. And it requires work as well, doesn't it?
And even with doing all that, you can still get knocked back. Like, for example, we went on a cruise at Christmas and I ended up with a head cold, a chest infection and COVID. So
that's not what you want on a cruise.
But that's sort of like atypical of low immunity.
Yeah.
Well, compromised immunity. So I think you've really got to accept that, get over it, and just get back to the normal routine, which is what we've done since. But people are probably a bit scared to travel. You know, there's, you know, for the fear of, you know, having a relapse or something, infection. But, I mean, it's you can still do it and then just get back to normal as quick as you can and enjoy.
Yeah.
And it's still an enjoyment to travel and, you know, like people don't want to be housebound worrying about what happens if I go to the supermarket and get COVID, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, even though there's a lot more COVID around than there used to be,
mm-hmm.
it's just a matter of having I guess if you get yourself to the point where you're pretty well fit and your quality of life is pretty good, you can deal with the setback because you know it's going to come back to that level again. It's not like you're going to deteriorate even further.
Well, it's that, and it's the resilience, isn't it, that you build within yourself and
got to be resilient. Yep.
Trusting within your body that, okay, I can't keep myself in a bubble, and if I did at home and isolated myself, well, we all know that's not good for one's mental health, and being able to do things that you enjoy. And for you, it sounds like it's traveling and being active and out there in the community, that if you were to take away all those things, that yes, you might not get ill, but there's lots of other counter reactions that will happen for you. And it's acknowledging the fear, going, yep, I'm a bit scared that I could get sick or something could happen, but I know I'm going to be okay and I can best protect myself, like, as we know, washing hands, wearing masks if we need to or feel comfortable to, and doing all the things to keep us safe, but still being able to enjoy life.
Yeah, for sure. And the other thing is, if you're too isolated, you sort of you lose the everyday bugs and that you might pick up but not actually affect you. So your immunity is sort of decreasing because you're more susceptible to everything. Over isolating, you're sort of more susceptible once you do go out.
Yeah, absolutely. And what joy that you've had to be able to travel again and enjoy that time with your wife as well.
Yeah, well, we're off again in March, but if I have some serious sort of event where I get COVID again or something, that might be the last trip, but it'll be worth it.
Yeah.
Doing a big trip. So, it's just got to be positive and know that you're in a good space to start with, and then you can come back to that space once you get over whatever you catch.
Yeah.
You know, you're not sort of feeling worse.
And do you feel a sense of, like, not saying that the myeloma is behind you or any or treatment's behind you, because it's definitely not, but do you feel a sense of going, well, I'm sitting in this life and I'm living and I'm being able to live to the best that I can, even post a diagnosis and regardless of the side effects? Do you feel a sense of, I want to say guilt or purpose, to go, okay, well, there's people that can't, or there's, as you said, there were people on the journey that you've met that haven't either been able to, I guess, I want to find, I'm tripping over my words, but I guess that passed away from this diagnosis. And have you ever felt any of that?
That's the main reason I got involved with consumer group with Leukemia Foundation, was to be able to give input into other organisations doing research into finding a better way or that optimum pathway.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of people are mismanaged during their recovery, and you can't go out and walk up to a hospital and say, this guy's died because you didn't look after him properly. But if I can make a contribution to better the outcomes in the future by having the pathway being
streamlined,
integrated. Make it, the norm, so everyone's treated the same and they've got the same chance of a good outcome. I sort of don't, you said about feeling guilty. I don't really feel guilty, but I feel I'm luckier than most because I've got picked up without any damage. Like most people get picked up with broken bones and lesions and all sorts of nasty things. But so in that sense, it's probably, not necessarily guilt, but just, I guess, I'm more of a empathy person, so I feel more empathy for the people that are doing it tougher than me.
Yep.
But not necessarily guilty, but if it called a passion or a response to what's happened to people I know, is more to make a positive contribution to improving things in the future as a way of doing something positive.
Impact, isn't it? Gone through what you have gone through, and it sounds like you really value the level of care that you were given and that you experienced. Yeah. And it sounds like maybe some of the people that you've come in contact with, you think, that didn't quite happen maybe the way it should, or they didn't get access to a service earlier than they should have. And it sounds like you've really kind of made it your passion to go, I want people to be able to get what I got. And
for sure.
Yeah, because everybody absolutely deserves that.
The biggest thing is, like, people not so much, I mean, in the different states have different treatment regimes. Like, some people get sent home and then they're looked after by a home nurse. Other people, like here, we go to Brisbane for our stem cell transplant.
Yeah.
But then we can go to another hospital in a regional area for our recovery. And that's where there's variations in protocols for treatment.
Mm.
And I was lucky to be referred to the Royal Brisbane and Women's Hospital to their cancer ward.
Mm-hmm.
They had a really strong regime about the importance of maintaining your weight. Like, you got weight every day, and they realised that was obviously from their professional experience that maintaining your weight's critical, because when you're recovering from getting the melphalan, you're burning up 30% more energy.
Isn't your body burns it.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you don't maintain your weight, you're not going to recover as well as you might otherwise do. So people that lose weight are going to just come out of hospital behind the eight ball, really, without having the chance to come out in the best condition they can be. Because it's still an ongoing recovery, because the melphalan affects your body for months afterwards. And it's all relative to best outcomes to, you know, maintain your weight.
Did you have to get a nasogastric tube at all, or were you able to eat the whole time?
I was lucky. Because what you do is, before you get the melphalan, you suck on a lot of ice.
Yeah.
Because the melphalan attacks your mucous membrane. So the least amount of impact you can have on your mucous membrane, the more likely you are to be able to eat properly. And whereas if it attacks your mucous membrane, then you've got to get the gastric tube. They do that at Royal Brisbane so that you may, you know, they're still giving you
the nutrition
nourishment that you need. I was lucky I didn't get the melphalan side effect.
You didn't get the ulcers and things like that.
No.
Which is so right, that if that happens, that's a side effect that puts you behind the eight ball of being able to eat and maintain and look after your body.
And also, they have a range of anti-nausea medication, because you do get nauseous. Like, I was nauseous for about 5 weeks after stem cell transplant, but they've got Stematils like a lolly compared to what they've got. They've got all these really good, I can't think of the names of them. Yeah, there's all sorts, one that you put on your tongue and half an hour later you feel like breakfast and, things like that. So it's really well managed. And that's what everyone needs to have access to. I think they do, but I think the critical thing is nutrition. That's what gets you off on the right foot.
Absolutely. And it sounds like, too, as you said, like at the beginning of this episode, that you were already preparing, that you were going to go in. So your exercise was a big focus as well. So you went in there as best you could.
I was lucky to have accommodation at the Leukemia Lodge in Hurston when I was at Royal Brisbane. So they had all heaps of information, and they were really helpful with advice, and that was an integral part of finding out about everything and the importance of maintaining your well-being by eating properly. And so that's how I really got started with involvement with Leukemia Foundation, because that was so helpful to me. I thought, well, just got to give it back. So it's been good to be invited to join the consumer group.
It's a great space for people who are passionate about helping, others that are just newly diagnosed, or, I guess the future as well. Because as you said, one of your passions is to ensure that people have access, equitable access to treatment and TENS services, no matter where they are in the country, which is something that we here at the Leukemia Foundation very much are passionate about. And it's a perfect space to be able to jump onto that. And this is how you and I became about, because I needed people to become on the podcast, and your name was put up. So,
also, the people that are, people that are doing their masters in something that's relative might want to might approach the Leukemia Foundation. There's lots of, I've been involved with lots of, people wanting information, and at the moment I've been invited to apply for the Wilder and Eliza Hall Institute facility down in Melbourne. They want to do a study on immunoglobulin, people that are on it. That was all through Matt and the consumer group. And obviously people that are trying to improve things know that they can approach you guys and get referrals from consumers, which has been really the way to go, because, there's a lot of people with different experiences that can help all sorts of other professional groups that don't have the insight that a consumer's got.
Absolutely. And I think that what it also highlights for me working within this organisation, I hope that it also highlights to other people out there that you're not alone, that there's a whole village and team of people that, you know, unfortunately this can be a really dark moment for a lot of people being diagnosed with a blood cancer, but there is a village of people that are so passionate about improving the life and improving the quality of life for people once a diagnosis has walked into not only their life, but their family's life as well. So, yeah, it's incredible. And I think the best thing that someone can do is reach out and speak, because you're not alone, are you?
No, that's right. And also the professionals are in the same boat, you know, in reverse, like they're scientists, but they got no idea of how what they're doing relates to the consumer. So
really that's true.
And their life's work is improving things for the consumer. So if a consumer can add some input to their understanding of the condition, well, it sort of makes better, helps them understand what their work's achieving.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I appreciate your time today. And as we do usually near the end of any episode, we do ask the patient that is on if they had any kind of golden nuggets that they would share with the listeners that they've learnt along the way or that they hold true to themselves.
Yeah.
Do you have anything you would like to share?
Yeah, I'd just like to thank you guys for inviting me to the Leukemia Foundation's, you know, Talking Blood Cancer podcast. It's been really enjoyable talking to you, Kate.
No, thank you.
And if anyone out there wants to listen to further, search Talking Blood Cancer on your podcast app.
Yeah.
And the words of wisdom, I've mentioned some of them. Like,
you have.
I think it's important to maintain your weight regardless of, well, I mean, you should be able to refer back to your care team if you're nauseous, you know, get better drugs. As he said, exercise is vitally important to prepare you for and maintain you in your ongoing journey. And third thing was, as we spoke earlier, was managing your day-to-day activity so that it's, you sort of maintain a positive attitude and don't get knocked back by overdoing things. Just work on, you will, I mean, you may do overdo it initially, but then you work out what your best plan of getting through the week is, and how you can incorporate exercise without exacerbating neuropathy or anything like that. So those three things, food, exercise, and your management plan for your own activity is the three goals, I think, that have helped me once I've worked them all out.
Yeah, and I think it from that, you know, listening to that, I hear that not only amongst all of that, and it's not always easy, but it's the willingness to adapt. Because, hear that all the time, that humans were very adaptable when we want to be, but it's making that conscious choice that, yep, look, this isn't where I thought I'd be, want to be, but I'm here. So I need to be willing to adapt to the current situation or circumstance that I am in life. So,
So that you're right. That's it. Don't overdo things to knock back your enthusiasm. Take it in your stride and then just cut things back until it's very manageable. And once you've got into a routine, then you can step it up possibly to improve, go forward.
Yeah, I very much agree. Look, I can't thank you enough. It's been an absolute joy speaking with you today. You are a man of lots of wisdom and I have a lot of time for you. And, you know, I think the listeners will really enjoy this episode. And it's got some beautiful golden nuggets sown throughout the entire episode. So I can't thank you again enough for sharing your time and your story and your outlook as well with us here today.
Yeah, thanks, Kate, for inviting me and helping me get through the podcast with all those relative questions.
No, my pleasure. My pleasure.
That brings us to the end of today's episode. We hope that you have found it helpful in some way. We here at the Leukemia Foundation are a proud member of Talking Health Tech Podcast Network. If you would like more information on today's show or our services, please feel free to call 1-800-620-420 and someone will be able to connect you with your local blood cancer support coordinator. Also, if you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe, share, or even give us a rating on your podcast app. Thank you for tuning in today. I'm Kate Arkadiff, and you've been listening to the Leukemia Foundation's podcast, Talking Blood Cancer.